Chapter 14. This Queer and Deadly Game. That afternoon, Tuesday, June 18th, at 3:49 p.m., Churchill stood before the House of Commons to address the French debacle, delivering a speech he would repeat that evening in a radio broadcast to the public. This speech, too, would go down as one of the great moments in oratory, at least as he delivered it in the House of Commons. Churchill spoke of parachute troops and airborne landings and of bombing attacks, which will certainly be made very soon upon us. While Germany had more bombers, he said, Britain had bombers too, and would deploy them without intermission to attack military targets in Germany. He reminded his audience that Britain had a navy. Some people seem to forget that, he said. He made no attempt, however, to skirt the true meaning of the French collapse. The Battle of France was over, he said, adding, I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. At stake was not only the British Empire, but all of Christian civilization. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. He marched toward his climax. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, and all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age made more sinister and perhaps more prolonged by the lights of a perverted science. He issued an appeal to the greater spirit of Britons everywhere. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Commonwealth and Empire lasts for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour. Arguably, this was Churchill's finest as well, and so it would have remained had he taken the recommendation of his Minister of Information to broadcast the speech live from the House chamber. As home intelligence had found, the public needed to hear from Churchill himself about the French fiasco and what it meant for Britain's prospects in the war. But the process of arranging a broadcast from the House, including a necessary vote of approval by members, proved too daunting. Churchill agreed, with reluctance, to do a separate broadcast that night. The ministry expected him to write something new, but, with a child's contrariness, he decided simply to reread the speech he had delivered in the Commons. Although public reaction, as measured through mass observation and home intelligence reports, varied, one consistent theme was criticism of Churchill's delivery. Some suggested he was drunk, mass observation reported on Wednesday, June 19th. Others that he did not himself feel the confidence he was proclaiming. A few thought he was tired. It would seem that the delivery to some extent counteracted the contents of the speech. Cecil King, editorial director of the Daily Mirror, wrote in his diary, Whether he was drunk or all in from sheer fatigue, I don't know, but it was the poorest possible effort on an occasion when he should have produced the finest speech of his life. One listener went so far as to send a telegram to 10 Downing Street warning that Churchill sounded as though he had a heart condition and recommended he work lying down. As it happened, the problem was largely mechanical. Churchill had insisted on reading the speech with a cigar clenched in his mouth. The next day, Churchill's top three military commanders, his chiefs of staff, sent a secret note, to be kept under lock and key, to Churchill and his war cabinet, via Pug Ismay, in which they laid out the coming danger in terms more stark than Churchill had detailed in his speech. Experience of the campaign in Flanders and France indicates that we can expect no period of respite before the Germans may begin a new phase of the war, the note read. We must, therefore, regard the threat of invasion as immediate. But first would come an assault from the air, the chiefs explained, one that will tax our air defences and the morale of our people to the full. Hitler would spare nothing, they warned. The Germans have accepted prodigious losses in France and are likely to be prepared to face even higher losses and to take even greater risks than they took in Norway to achieve decisive results against this country. The next 3 months, they predicted, would determine the outcome of the war. On Thursday, there were more rumours that Churchill would hold a meeting devoted solely to beam navigation. The meeting, Dr. Jones now heard, would take place the next morning, Friday, June 21st. No one had invited him, however, so on that Friday morning he kept to his usual routine, which involved catching a train from London's Richmond district at 9:35 and arriving at work about 35 minutes later. When he got to his office, he found a note from a secretary in the Air Intelligence Branch stating that a colleague, Squadron Leader Rowley Scott Farney, has telephoned and says, "Will you go to the Cabinet Room in 10 Downing Street?" At 10 Downing, the Cabinet Room began filling with officials. Here was the long table, a 25-foot span of polished wood covered with green cloth, toothed by the backs of 22 mahogany chairs. The Prime Minister's chair, the only armchair, was at the centre of one side of the table in front of a large marble fireplace. Tall windows afforded views of the back garden and, beyond, the Horse Guards Parade and St. James's Park. At each seat was a writing pad, a blotter, and notepaper with 10 Downing Street embossed in black at the top. From time to time, Churchill used the room as his base for dictating telegrams and minutes. A secretary would sit opposite him with a typewriter, sometimes for hours, typing item after item, with Churchill holding out his hand for it almost before he had finished dictating, wrote Elizabeth Leighton. At the ready were his klop, his hole punch, and two pens, one with blue-black ink for signing correspondence, one with red ink for initialing minutes. If he needed something, he would hold out a hand and say, "Gimme," and Leighton was expected to know what device he wanted. He used the same command to summon people. "Gimme Prof," or "Gimme Pug," meant she was to call for Lindemann or General Ismay. During long, quiet stretches, she listened to the chimes of Big Ben and the Horse Guards clock, both of which sounded at quarterly intervals with a pleasing dissonance, the clang of the Horse Guards clock against the stately boom of Big Ben. The officials took their seats. Here came Churchill, Lindemann, Lord Beaverbrook, and the Empire's top aviation officials, including Air Minister Sir Archibald Sinclair and Fighter Command Chief Hugh Dowding, a dozen or so men in all. Present as well was Henry Tizard, who advised the government on aeronautical affairs. A one-time friend of Lindemann's, Tizard had become estranged from the Prof, in large part because of the Prof's virtuosity at nursing grudges. No secretaries were present, private or personal, indicating that the meeting was deemed so secret that no written record would be kept. There was tension in the room. Tizard and Lindemann were feuding over past imagined slights. The animus between them was clearly evident. Churchill noticed that one key man, Jones, the young scientist whose detective work had caused the meeting to be convened in the first place, was absent. The discussion began without him. With the fall of France, the urgency of the matter was growing by the day. The Luftwaffe was moving its bases steadily closer to the French coast. Its raids over the English mainland were growing in size, severity, and frequency. Two nights earlier, the Luftwaffe had sent 150 aircraft over England, damaging steelworks and a chemical plant, destroying gas and water mains, sinking one merchant ship, and nearly blowing up an ammunition depot in Southampton. 10 civilians were killed. It was all part of the mounting drumbeat of suspense as to when the Germans would invade, like the slow build of a thriller, to use a word that debuted in 1889. The suspense was making people irritable and anxious, as well as more critical of the government, according to a Home Intelligence report. If German aircraft were indeed being guided at night by a secret new navigational system, it was crucial to know that and to devise some means of countering the technology as soon as possible. This realm of secret science was one in which Churchill took great delight. He loved gadgets and secret weapons and was an ardent promoter of the novel inventions proposed by the Prof, even those derided by other officials as the dreams of a crackpot. Upon the failure of an early prototype of an explosive device that adhered to the exterior of a tank, and occasionally to the soldier throwing it, Churchill rose to the Prof's defence. In a minute, addressed to Pug Ismay, but meant for wider distribution, Churchill wrote, "Any chortling by officials who have been slothful in pushing this bomb over the fact that it has not succeeded will be viewed with strong disfavour by me." The sticky bomb, as it was known, did eventually reach a point where it could be deployed in the field, despite opposition by the War Office. Churchill overrode the department's objections and gave the weapon his full support. In a June 1, 1940 minute, noteworthy for both its precision and its brevity, Churchill commanded, "Make 1 million, WSC. When, later, several members of Parliament began to question Lindemann's influence, Churchill bridled. During a contentious question time in the House of Commons, one member not only asked questions that implicitly criticised Lindemann, but made dark allusions to his German heritage, which infuriated Churchill. Afterward, he ran into the critic in the common smoking room and, bellowing at him like an infuriated bull, according to one witness, shouted, "Why in hell did you ask that question? Don't you know that he is one of my oldest and greatest friends?" Churchill told the man to get the hell out, and never to speak to him again. In an aside to his own parliamentary secretary, Churchill said, "Love me, love my dog. And if you don't love my dog, you damn well can't love me." Dr. Jones still thought the meeting at 10 Downing Street might be a prank. He tracked down the secretary who had put the note on his desk that morning. She assured him that the invitation was real. Still unconvinced, Jones paid a call on Squadron Leader Scott Farney, the colleague who had telephoned the original message to the secretary. He, too, avowed that this was no prank. Jones caught a taxi. By the time he reached number 10, the meeting had been underway for nearly half an hour. For Jones, this was an unnerving moment. As he entered the room, Churchill and a dozen other men turned his way. Jones was a bit stunned to find himself, all of 28 years old, looking down the centre of the legendary long table in the cabinet room. Churchill was seated midway down the left side of the table, flanked by Lindemann and Lord Beaverbrook, the two men antipodes in appearance, Lindemann pale and soap-featured, Beaverbrook animated and bilious, every bit the scowling elf captured in newspaper photographs. At the other side of the table sat Henry Tizard, Air Minister Sinclair, and Fighter Command's Dowding. Jones sensed the tension in the room. Lindemann gestured toward the empty seat to his right. The men on Tizard's side signalled that he should come sit with them. For an instant, Jones was flummoxed. Lindemann was his former professor and undoubtedly the main reason he had been invited to the meeting in the first place. But the air staff men were his colleagues, and by all rights he should sit with them. What further complicated the moment was that Jones was well aware of the ill feeling between Tizard and Lindemann. Jones resolved the quandary by taking a chair at the end of the table, in what he called the no-man's land, between the two delegations. He listened as others renewed their conversation. He judged by their comments that the group had only a partial understanding of the beam situation and its implications for aerial warfare. At one point, Churchill addressed a question directly to him, to clarify a detail. Instead of merely answering, Jones said, "Would it help, sir, if I told you the story right from the start?" In retrospect, he was startled by his own sang-froid. He attributed his calmness in part to the fact that his summons to the meeting had so taken him by surprise that he had not had an opportunity to let his anxiety build. Jones told it as a detective story, describing the early clues and the subsequent accumulation of evidence. He revealed, as well, some fresh intelligence, including a note pulled just 3 days earlier from a downed German bomber that seemed to confirm his hunch that the Knickerbein system deployed not just one beam, but two, with the second one intersecting the first over the intended target. The note pegged the second beam's point of origin as Bredstedt, a town in Schleswig-Holstein on Germany's north coast. It also provided what appeared to be the frequencies of the beams. Churchill listened, rapt, his fascination for secret technologies in full flare. But he also realized the bleak significance of Jones's discovery. It was bad enough that the Luftwaffe was establishing itself at bases on captured territory, just minutes from the English coast, but now he understood that the aircraft at those bases would be able to bomb accurately, even on moonless nights and in overcast weather. To Churchill, this was dark news indeed, one of the blackest moments of the war, as he later put it. Until this point, he had been confident that the RAF could hold its own, despite being, as air intelligence believed, vastly outnumbered by the Luftwaffe. In daylight, RAF pilots were proving adept at bringing down Germany's slow-moving bombers and besting their fighter escorts, which were hamstrung by having to hang back to protect the slower aircraft and by fuel limitations that gave the fighters only 90 minutes of flying time. At night, however, the RAF was powerless to intercept German aircraft. If the German planes could bomb accurately, even in heavy overcast, and on the darkest nights, They would no longer need their swarms of fighter escorts, and no longer be restrained by the fighters' fuel limits. They could traverse the British Isles without restriction, a tremendous advantage in laying the groundwork for invasion. Jones talked for 20 minutes. When he was done, Churchill recalled there was a general air of incredulity in the room, though some at the table were clearly concerned. Churchill asked what should now be done. "The first step," Jones said, "was to use aircraft to confirm that the beams actually existed, and then to fly among them to understand their character." Jones knew that if indeed the Germans were using a Lorentz system, like that employed by commercial airliners, it had to have certain characteristics. Transmitters on the ground would send signals through two separate antennae. These signals would spread and become diffuse at long distances. But were they overlapped, they would form a strong, narrow beam, in the way that two shadows become darker at the point where they intersect. It was this beam that commercial pilots would follow until they saw the runway below. The transmitter sent a long dash signal through one antenna and a shorter dot signal through the other, both made audible by the pilot's receiver. If the pilot had a strong dash signal, he knew to move to the right, until the dot signal gained strength. When he was centered on the correct approach path, where both dashes and dots had equal strength, the so-called equisignal zone, he heard a single continuous tone. Once the nature of the beam system was known, Jones told the men in the meeting the RAF could devise countermeasures, including jamming the beams and transmitting false signals to trick the Germans into dropping their bombs too early or flying along the wrong course. At this, Churchill's mood improved. "The load was once again lifted," he later told Jones. He ordered the search for the beams to begin immediately. He also proposed that such beams made it all the more important to press ahead with one of the Prof's pet secret weapons, the aerial mine, which Lindemann had been promoting since well before the war, and which had become an obsession for him and Churchill alike. These mines were small explosive devices hung by wire from parachutes that could be dropped by the thousands in the path of German bomber formations to be snagged by wings and propellers. Lindemann went so far as to propose a plan to protect London by raising a nightly mine curtain, nearly 20 miles long, replenished by successive flights of mine-dispensing aircraft that would drop 250,000 mines per six-hour night. Churchill fully endorsed Lindemann's mines, although most everyone else doubted their worth. At Churchill's insistence, the Air Ministry and Beaverbrook's Ministry of Aircraft Production had developed and tested prototypes, but only half-heartedly, and this caused Churchill great frustration. The inevitable Luftwaffe assault demanded the thorough examination of every possible means of defence. Now, at the meeting, his frustration blazed anew. It seemed clear to him that the existence of German navigation beams, if proven, added new urgency to fulfilling the Prof's dream, because if these beams could be located, suddenly the placement of aerial mines along the paths of inbound bombers would become much more precise. But so far, the whole program seemed bogged down in studies and minutes. He banged on the table. "All I get from the Air Ministry," he growled, "his files, files, files." Tizard, in part driven by his hostility toward Lindemann, scoffed at Jones's story. But Churchill, convinced about the principles of this queer and deadly game, declared that the existence of the German beam should be treated as established fact. He understood that soon Hitler would turn the full strength of the Luftwaffe against England. Work on countering the beams was to be given precedence over all else, he said, and the slightest reluctance or deviation in carrying out this policy was to be reported to him. Tizard, his objections ignored and his loathing for Lindemann inflamed anew, took this as a personal affront. Shortly after the meeting, he resigned both from his position as chairman of the Scientific Advisory Committee and as an advisor to the Air Staff. It was in such moments that Churchill most appreciated the Prof. "There were no doubt greater scientists," Churchill acknowledged, "but he had two qualifications of vital consequence to me. First was the fact that Lindemann was my friend and trusted confidant of 20 years, Churchill wrote. "The Prof's second qualification was his ability to distill arcane science into simple, easy-to-grasp concepts, to decipher the signals from the experts on the far horizons, and explain to me in lucid, homely terms what the issues were." Once thus armed, Churchill could turn on his power relay, the authority of office, and transform concepts into action. A search flight to attempt to locate the beams was scheduled for that evening. Jones got little sleep that night. He had put his career on the line before the Prime Minister and Lindemann and the most senior men of the Royal Air Force. His mind paged back through the entire meeting, one detail to the next. Had I, after all, he wondered, made a fool of myself and misbehaved so spectacularly in front of the Prime Minister? Had I jumped to false conclusions? Had I fallen for a great hoax by the Germans? Above all, had I arrogantly wasted an hour of the Prime Minister's time when Britain was about to be invaded or obliterated from the air? Churchill had further cause for relief that day, a kind of financial Dunkirk. As the war deepened and the demands on him intensified, he wrestled with a personal problem that had dogged him through much of his career, a lack of money. He wrote books and articles to supplement his official income. Until his appointment as Prime Minister, he had written columns for the Daily Mirror and News of the World, and had done broadcasts for American radio, also for the money. But it had never been enough, and now he was nearing a financial crisis, unable to fully pay his taxes and routine bills, including those from his tailors, his wine supplier, and the shop that repaired his watch. He had nicknamed his watch the Turnip. What's more, he owed his bank, Lloyd's, a lot of money. His account statement for Tuesday, June 18th, had cited an overdraft amounting to over £5,000, equal to more than $300,000 in 21st century American dollars. An interest payment on this was due at the end of the month, and he lacked the money to pay even that much. But that Friday of the Beam meeting, a cheque in the amount of £5,000 mysteriously and conveniently turned up in his Lloyd's account. The name on the deposited cheque was that of Brendan Bracken, Churchill's parliamentary private secretary, but the true source was Bracken's wealthy co-owner of The Economist magazine, Sir Henry Strakosch. 3 days earlier, upon receiving a statement from Lloyd's listing his overdraft, Churchill had called Bracken to his office. He was fed up with the distraction and pressure caused by his financial troubles and had far more important matters to confront. He told Bracken to fix the situation, and Bracken did. The Lloyd's payment did not get Churchill out of debt entirely, but it removed the immediate risk of an embarrassing personal default. The next day, Saturday, Dr. Jones attended a meeting convened to hear the results of the previous night's flight to search for German beams. The pilot, Flight Lieutenant H.E. Bufton, appeared in person and delivered a concise report with 3 numbered items. He and an observer had taken off from an airfield near Cambridge, with instructions only to fly north and look for transmissions like those generated by Ellerent's blind landing system. First, Bufton reported finding a narrow beam in the air a mile south of Spalding, a town near England's North Sea coast, where the coastline bulges inward in a large bay called the Wash. The flight detected transmissions of dots just south of the beam and dashes to the north, as would be expected with a Lorentz-style beacon. Second, Bufton reported that the frequency of the detected beam was 31.5 megacycles per second, the frequency previously identified in one of the notes retrieved by Air Intelligence. And then came the best news of all, at least for Jones. The flight had detected a second beam, with similar characteristics, that crossed the first at a point near Derby, home to a Rolls-Royce factory that produced all the Merlin engines for the RAF Spitfires and Hurricanes. This second beam, on a different frequency, would necessarily intersect the first shortly before the target, to give the German crew time to drop their bombs. Despite the fact that the point of intersection seemed to indicate that the Rolls factory was a target, there was jubilation. For Jones especially, it was a great relief. The officer in charge of the meeting, Jones recalled, was actually skipping round the room in delight. Now came the urgent effort to find an effective way of countering the beams. Knickerbein received the codename Headache, the potential countermeasures Aspirin. First, though, Jones and a colleague walked to nearby St. Stephen's Tavern, a popular Whitehall pub situated 100 yards from Big Ben, and got drunk. Chapter 15. London and Berlin. At 6:36 p.m., Saturday, June 22nd, the French signed an armistice with Hitler. Britain was now officially alone. At Chequers the next day, the news about France soured the atmosphere. A wrathful and gloomy breakfast downstairs, Mary wrote in her diary. Churchill was in a black mood. What consumed his thoughts and darkened his spirits was the French fleet. Germany had not immediately disclosed the precise terms of the armistice, and thus the official fate of the fleet remained a mystery. That Hitler would annex its ships seemed certain. The effect would be catastrophic, likely both to change the balance of power in the Mediterranean and to make a German invasion of England even more certain. Churchill's behaviour annoyed Clementine. She sat down to write him a letter, recognising, as always, that the best way to get his attention for anything was in writing. She began, "I hope you will forgive me if I tell you something that I feel you ought to know." She completed the letter, but then tore it up. In Berlin, victory seemed near. On Sunday, June 23rd, Joseph Goebbels, whose official title was Minister for Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda, convened the regular morning meeting of his chief propaganda operatives, this one to address the new direction of the war, now that France had made its capitulation official. With France quelled, Goebbels told the group, England must now become the focus of their attention. He warned against doing anything that would cause the public to believe that a quick victory would follow. It is still impossible to say in what form the fight against Britain will now be continued, and on no account, therefore, must the impression be created that the occupation of Britain is about to start tomorrow, Goebbels said, according to minutes of the meeting. On the other hand, there can be no doubt that Britain will receive the same sentence as France if she persists in closing her mind to sensible considerations, meaning a peace agreement. With Britain now casting itself as the last guardian of European liberty, Goebbels said, Germany must stress in reply that we are now the leaders in the clash between continental Europe and the plutocratic British island people. Germany's foreign language transmitters must henceforth deliberately and systematically operate with slogans on the lines of Nations of Europe, Britain is organizing your starvation, etc. In a remark not recorded in the minutes but later quoted by a member of the Reich press office, Goebbels told the group, Well, this week will bring the great swing in Britain, meaning that with France fallen, the English public would now surely clamour for peace. Churchill, of course, can't hold on, he said. A compromise government will be formed. We are very close to the end of the war. Chapter 16. The Red Warning. In London, on Monday, June 24th, Churchill's war cabinet met three times, once in the morning and twice that night, the last meeting beginning at 10:30 p.m. Most of the time was spent discussing what Foreign Under-Secretary Cadogan called the awful problem of the French fleet. Earlier that day, the Times of London had revealed the terms of the French armistice, which Germany had not yet formally disclosed. German forces would occupy the northern and western tiers of France. The rest of the country would be administered by a nominally free government based in Vichy, about 200 miles south of Paris. It was Article 8 that Churchill read most intently. The German government solemnly declared that they have no intention of using for their own purposes during the war the French fleet, stationed in ports under German control, except those units necessary for coast surveillance and mine sweeping. It also called for all French ships operating outside French waters to return to France, unless they were needed to protect French colonial holdings. The clause, as later published by Germany, included this sentence: The German government further solemnly and expressly declare that they do not intend to claim the French fleet on the conclusion of peace. Churchill did not, for an instant, believe that Germany would honour this declaration. Hitler's persistent dishonesty aside, the language of the article by itself seemed to offer great leeway in how he deployed French ships. What exactly did coastal surveillance entail, or minesweeping? Churchill scoffed at Germany's solemn promise. As he later told Parliament, ask half a dozen countries what is the value of such a solemn assurance. Despite the three cabinet meetings, the ministers made little progress towards shaping a final course of action. Just after the last meeting came to an end, At 1:15 on Tuesday morning, air raid sirens began to howl, the city's first red warning since the previous September when the war began. The alert meant an attack was imminent, but no bombers appeared. The warning had been triggered by a civilian aircraft. While waiting for the all-clear siren to sound, mass observation diarist Olivia Cockett opened her diary and wrote, "The night is very still. The clock ticks loudly. Four bowls of roses and one of tall white lilies scent the air deliciously." As her family watched, she took the lilies and lay down on the rug, propping them on her chest in funereal fashion. "All laughed," she wrote, "but not very uproariously." Home Intelligence reported that Tuesday that 10 to 20% of London's population failed to hear the air raid warning. Many people did not leave their bedrooms, the report said, and parents were reluctant to awaken children. A 7-year-old girl came up with a term for the sirens, the wibble wobbles. The threat of invasion seemed to grow daily. On Friday, June 28th, Churchill received a note from Dr. Jones of Air Intelligence, who seemed to have a talent for delivering disconcerting news. In this note, Jones reported that the same unimpeachable source who had provided critical information about the German beams had learned that an anti-aircraft unit of the German Air Force, known as Flak Corps 1, was requesting 1,100 maps of England of various scales for immediate shipment to its headquarters. Jones pointed out that this could indicate an intention to land motorized anti-aircraft units in both England and Ireland. Such a force would be necessary to help an invading army protect itself from the RAF and consolidate its hold on captured ground. Churchill knew that the unimpeachable source was not in fact a human spy, but rather the elite code-breaking unit at Bletchley Park. He was one of the few senior officials in Whitehall who knew of the unit's existence. Jones, as Deputy Director of Air Intelligence, also knew. Bletchley's secrets were delivered to Churchill in a special yellow dispatch box, separate from his regular black box, that only he was authorized to open. The intercepted map request was troubling in that it was the kind of concrete preparatory measure that would be expected before an invasion. Churchill immediately sent copies of the message to the Prof and Pug Ismay. The next 3 months, Churchill judged, were the period when the threat of invasion would be greatest, after which the weather would become progressively more hostile and thus a deterrent. The tone of his minutes grew more urgent and more precise. Prodded by the Prof, he told Pug Ismay that trenches were to be dug across any open field more than 400 yards long to defend against tanks and landings by troop-carrying aircraft, specifying that this should be done simultaneously throughout the country in the next 48 hours. In a separate note, on Sunday, June 30th, he ordered Pug to see that a study was made of tides and moon phases in the Thames estuary and elsewhere to determine on which days conditions will be most favourable to a seaborne landing. Also that Sunday, he sent Pug a minute on a subject of particular sensitivity, the use of poison gas against invading forces. Supposing lodgements were effected on our coast, there could be no better points for application of mustard than these beaches and lodgements, he wrote. In my view, there would be no need to wait for the enemy to adopt such methods. He will certainly adopt them if he thinks it will pay. He asked Ismay to determine whether drenching the beaches with gas would be effective. Another threat caused him particular worry. German parachutists and fifth columnists in disguise. Much thought, he wrote, must be given to the trick of wearing British uniform. The stress of managing the war began to take its toll on Churchill, and Clementine grew alarmed. During the previous weekend at Chequers, he had been a boor. Having discarded her first letter on the subject, she now wrote to him again. She reported that a member of Churchill's inner circle, whom she did not identify, has been to me and told me there is a danger of your being generally disliked by your colleagues and subordinates because of your rough, sarcastic, and overbearing manner. She assured her husband that the source of this complaint was a devoted friend, with no axe to grind. Churchill's private secretary, she wrote, seemed to have resolved simply to take it and shrug it off. Higher up, if an idea is suggested, say at a conference, You are supposed to be so contemptuous that presently no ideas, good or bad, will be forthcoming. Hearing this shocked and hurt her, she said, because in all these years I have been accustomed to all those who have worked with and under you loving you. Seeking to explain the degradation in Churchill's behavior, the devoted friend had said, no doubt it's the strain. But it was not just the friend's observations that drove Clementine to write her letter. My darling Winston, she began, I must confess that I have noticed a deterioration in your manner, and you are not so kind as you used to be. She cautioned that in possessing the power to give orders and to sack anyone and everyone, he was obliged to maintain a high standard of behavior, to combine urbanity, kindness, and, if possible, Olympic calm. She reminded him that in the past he had been fond of quoting a French maxim, On ne règne sur les âmes que par la calme, meaning, essentially, one leads by calm. She wrote, I cannot bear that those who serve the country and yourself should not love you as well as admire and respect you. She warned, you won't get the best results by irascibility and rudeness. They will breed either dislike or a slave mentality, rebellion in wartime being out of the question. She closed, please forgive your loving, devoted, and watchful Clemmy. At the bottom of the page she drew a caricature of a cat at rest, with a curled tail, and added a postscript. I wrote this at Chequers last Sunday, tore it up, but here it is now. The irascible Churchill she depicted was not, however, what John Colville encountered that morning when, at 10 o'clock, he entered Churchill's bedroom at 10 Downing Street. The Prime Minister seemed remarkably at ease. He lay in bed, propped up by his bed rest. He wore a bright red dressing gown and was smoking a cigar. Beside him was a large chrome cuspidor for his expended cigars, a Savoy Hotel ice bucket, and the box, open and half full of papers. He was dictating to Mrs. Hill, who sat at the foot of the bed with her typewriter. Cigar smoke misted the room. Churchill's black cat, Nelson, lay also at the foot of the bed, in a full cat sprawl, the portrait of peace and repose. Now and then Churchill gazed adoringly at the cat and murmured, "Cat, darling." Chapter 17. Tofrek. As a refuge from the pressures and distractions of weekdays in London, Chequers was proving a godsend to Churchill. By now it had become his country command post, to which he summoned legions of guests, generals, ministers, foreign officials, family, staff, who were invited to dine, to sleep, or to dine and sleep. He brought a private secretary, leaving others on duty in London, two typists, his valet, his chauffeur, two telephone operators, and always Inspector Thompson. Barbed wire surrounded the grounds. Soldiers of the Coldstream Guard patrolled its hills and vales and boundaries. Sentries guarded all access points and demanded passwords from everyone, including Churchill himself. Every day, messengers delivered reports and minutes and the latest intelligence, all to be placed in his black box or in his top-secret yellow box. He received 8 daily and Sunday newspapers and read them. Although he took time out for meals, walks, baths, and his nap, he spent most of the day dictating minutes and discussing the war with his guests, much as he did at 10 Downing. But here, with a crucial difference. The House fostered an easier and more candid exchange of ideas and opinions, encouraged by the simple fact that everyone had left their offices behind, and by a wealth of novel opportunities for conversation, climbs up Beacon and Coombe Hills, walks in the Rose Garden, rounds of croquet, and hands of bezique, further leavened by free-flowing champagne, whisky, and brandy. The talk typically ranged well past midnight. At Chequers, visitors knew they could speak more freely than in London, and with absolute confidentiality. After one weekend, Churchill's new commander-in-chief of home forces, Alan Brooke, wrote to thank him for periodically inviting him to Chequers, and giving me an opportunity of discussing the problems of the defence of this country with you, and of putting some of my difficulties before you. These informal talks are of the very greatest help to me, and I do hope you realize how grateful I am to you for your kindness. Churchill, too, felt more at ease at Chequers, and understood that here he could behave as he wished, secure in the knowledge that whatever happened within would be kept secret, possibly a misplaced trust, given the memoirs and diaries that emerged after the war, like desert flowers after a first rain. This was, he said, a cercle sacré, a sacred circle. General Brooke recalled one night when Churchill, at 2:15 a.m., suggested that everyone present retire to the Great Hall for sandwiches, which Brooke, exhausted, hoped was a signal that soon the night would end and he could get to bed. But no, he wrote. What followed was one of those moments often to occur at Chequers that would remain lodged in visitors' minds forever after. He had the gramophone turned on, wrote Brooke, and in the many-coloured dressing gown, with a sandwich in one hand and watercress in the other, he trotted round and round the hall, giving occasional little skips to the tune of the gramophone. At intervals, as he rounded the room, he would stop to release some priceless quotation or thought. During one such pause, Churchill likened a man's life to a walk down a passage lined with closed windows. As you reach each window, an unknown hand opens it, and the light it lets in only increases by contrast the darkness of the end of the passage. He danced on. On that last weekend in June, the house filled to bursting. At least 10 guests came, some to dine and sleep. Lord Beaverbrook arrived, brimming with exuberance and bile. Alexander Harding, private secretary to the King, came for tea only. Churchill's son Randolph and his 20-year-old wife, Pamela, also arrived to spend the weekend. Now, too, came General Bernard Paget, chief of the General Staff of the Home Forces, and Leopold Amory, the Conservative Member of Parliament, whose stirring Cromwellian cry, "In the name of God, go!" had helped put Churchill in power. The conversation traversed a broad terrain. Aircraft production, the novelty of German armoured warfare, the French failure, how to manage the Duke of Windsor, whose abdication to marry Wallace Simpson 4 years earlier continued to cause much upheaval, and where and how invading forces were likely to land. One guest, General Augustus Francis Andrew Nicol Thorne, commander of forces assigned to defend the English coast, where the channel was at its narrowest, declared himself convinced that his zone was the prime target and that Germany would attempt to put 80,000 men on its beaches. On Saturday afternoon, June 29th, while Churchill and Beaverbrook talked privately and, as it happened, heatedly, John Colville took advantage of the respite and spent the afternoon, sunny and warm, in the garden with Clementine and daughter Mary, whom I find very much nicer on closer acquaintance, he wrote. Tea followed, after which Randolph Churchill provided Colville with a glimpse of a coarser side to Churchill family life. I thought Randolph one of the most objectionable people I had ever met. Noisy, self-assertive, whining, and frankly unpleasant, wrote Colville. He did not strike me as intelligent. Indeed, Randolph had a reputation as a rude houseguest. He was known to start verbal fights with even the most august of dinner companions, and seemed intent on antagonizing all around. He waged what Colville called preventive war, denouncing guests for what he expected them to say rather than what they actually said. Often he started fights with Churchill himself, to Churchill's great embarrassment. It did not help that he routinely picked his nose in public and coughed in relentless gusts. His coughing is like some huge dredger that brings up sea-changed things, wrote Lady Diana Cooper, wife of Minister of Information Duff Cooper, who professed to be a friend of Randolph's. He spews them out into his hand. Things got worse at dinner, Colville wrote. Randolph was anything but kind to Winston, who adores him. He made a scene in front of Home Forces Staff Chief Paget, criticizing generals, lack of equipment, and government complacency. As the day's consumption of alcohol caught up with him, Randolph grew noisier and still more objectionable. Randolph's wife, Pamela, was his antithesis, charming, light-hearted, and flirtatious. Though only 20, she exhibited the sophistication and confidence of an older woman, as well as a degree of sexual knowingness unusual for her circle. This had been apparent even 2 years earlier, when Pamela had come out as a debutante. Pam was terribly sexy and very obvious, a fellow debutante said. She was very plump and so bosomy, we all called her the dairymaid. She wore high heels and tossed her bottom around. We thought she was quite outrageous. She was known as Hot Stuff, a very sexy young thing. An American visitor, Kathy Harriman, wrote, "She's a wonderful girl, my age, but one of the wisest young girls I've ever met. Knows everything political and otherwise." Through her marriage, Pamela grew close to the Churchills. She was also befriended by Lord Beaverbrook, who valued her ability to circulate at the highest levels of society. "She passed everything she knew about anybody to Beaverbrook," said an American broadcaster, Regan McCrary, better known as Tex, a columnist for William Randolph Hearst's New York Daily Mirror. Beaverbrook was a gossip monger and Pamela was his bird dog. Pamela and Randolph had gotten married on October 4, 1939, after a brief courtship whose haste was at least partly driven by Randolph's desire to have a child, a son to be his heir, before being shipped off to battle and dying, an outcome he believed to be inevitable. He proposed to Pamela on their second date, and she, matching impulse for impulse, accepted. He was nearly a decade older and stunningly handsome, but the thing that appealed most to her was that he was a Churchill, at the center of power. Although Clementine did not approve of the marriage, Churchill, calling Pamela a charming girl, opened his arms wide and saw no problem with the speed at which the relationship had advanced. "I expect that he will be in action in the early spring," Churchill wrote to a friend shortly before the wedding, "and therefore I am very glad that he should be married before he goes." Churchill believed marriage to be a simple thing, and sought to dispel its mysteries through a series of aphorisms. "All you need to be married are champagne, a box of cigars, and a double bed," he said. Or this: "One of the secrets of a happy marriage is never to speak to or see the loved one before noon." Churchill had a formula for family size as well. 4 children was the ideal number. 1 to reproduce your wife, 1 to reproduce yourself, 1 for the increase in population, and 1 in case of accident. Clementine's unease about the marriage stemmed more from her concerns about her son than about Pamela. Clementine's relationship with Randolph had always been a tense one. As a child, he was difficult. Combative, according to one headmaster. He once pushed a nanny into a filled bathtub. On another occasion, he telephoned the Foreign Office and pretended to be Churchill. One account holds that he encouraged a cousin to empty a chamber pot through an open window onto Lloyd George. When he was 9 years old, Clementine, during a school visit, slapped him, an act that Randolph later identified as the moment when he realized she hated him. He was an unremarkable student and drew frequent criticism from Churchill for his lack of scholarly rigor. Churchill condemned even his penmanship, and once returned the boy's loving letter home with editorial corrections marked in red. Randolph got into Oxford only through the kindly intercession of Frederick Lindemann, the prof, who treated him like a beloved nephew. There, too, he failed to excel. "Your idle and lazy life is very offensive to me," Churchill wrote. "You appear to be leading a perfectly useless existence." Churchill loved him, John Colville wrote, but over time liked him less and less. Clementine, meanwhile, was by any standard a remote parent who expressed little maternal warmth. "That was one of the reasons he was such a nightmare," a friend told Christopher Ogden, Pamela's biographer. "He never got any maternal love at all. Clemmy hated Randolph all his life." Mary Churchill offered a more nuanced analysis of her brother, observing that, as his personality developed, it produced features of character and outlook too dissimilar from his mother's whole nature and attitude to life. As Mary saw it, Randolph manifestly needed a father's hand, but the main task of controlling him fell almost entirely upon Clementine, and so right from the early days she and Randolph were at loggerheads. He was loud, lacked tact, drank too much, spent beyond his income. His army pay and the salary he received as a correspondent for Beaverbrook's Evening Standard, and gambled with startling ineptitude. Even as Churchill tried to stabilize his own financial condition that spring, Randolph asked for help paying his debts, which Churchill agreed to do. "It was indeed generous of you to say that you would meet £100 of my bills," Randolph wrote to his father on June 2nd. That portion alone was equivalent to over $6,000 in 21st century dollars. "I do hope it is not very inconvenient for you to do this. I enclose the two most urgent. More troubling, in terms of the couple's marital future, was Randolph's attitude toward women and sex. To him, fidelity was a fungible condition. He loved sexual conquest, whether his target was married or not, and he took full advantage of the wicked centuries-old custom at country homes whereby hosts arranged guest accommodations to foster sexual liaisons. Randolph once bragged that he would enter the rooms of women without invitation, just in case his presence might be welcomed. He told this to a female friend, who quipped sardonically, "You must get lots of rebuffs." He said, laughing, "I do, but I get a lot of fucking, too." From the start, Randolph demonstrated that he was anything but an ideal husband. Though he conveyed an image of dash and charm, he also had a tedious side. During their honeymoon, while in bed at night, he would read to Pamela from The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. He read lengthy passages and treated Pamela more like a distracted pupil than a marital bedmate, asking at intervals, "Are you listening?" "Yes," she would answer. But he wanted proof. "Well, what was the last sentence?" For the moment, all this was eclipsed by the fact that Pamela was now 6 months pregnant. It was very reassuring. Here, in the midst of a world conflagration, came proof that the greater rhythms of life persisted and that a future lay ahead, despite the uncertain prospects of the moment. If all went well, if Hitler did not invade, if poison gas did not come seeping through the windows, if a German bomb did not obliterate the landscape, the child would arrive in October. Pamela called the fetus her baby dumpling. After dinner, after more wine and champagne, Colville took a walk with Mary and another guest, Mary's friend Judy Montague, and received a reminder that, as bucolic and lovely as the estate was, there was a war underway, and Chequers was under close guard. The three found themselves challenged in the most alarming way by ferocious sentries, Colville wrote. Happily, they knew the day's password. Tofrek, apparently a reference to a 19th-century battle in the Sudan. Later, upon checking in with the Air Ministry in London for details on German raids that night, Colville learned that a fleet of enemy planes had just been reported very near to Chequers. Colville relayed this to Churchill, who told him, "I'll bet you a monkey to a mousetrap they don't hit the house." Excited at the prospect of action, Churchill rushed out of the building past a sentry while shouting, "Friend, Tofrek, Prime Minister!" which left the guard slack-jawed with surprise. Colville and General Paget, the Home Forces staff chief, followed at a slower pace. Paget, amused, said, "What a wonderful tonic he is." All this was heady stuff for Colville, always present yet always in the background. And the next morning, Sunday, June 30th, as he sat in a chair in the sun, he reflected in his diary on the strangeness of his situation. It is a curious feeling to stay for the weekend in a country house, not as a guest, and yet, for a number of reasons, on fairly close terms with the family. It was much like any weekend party except for the conversation, which, of course, was brilliant. It is a pleasure to hear really well-informed talk, unpunctuated by foolish and ignorant remarks, except occasionally from Randolph. And it is a relief to be in the background, with occasional commissions to execute, but few views to express, instead of being expected to be interesting because one is the PM's private secretary. That day, as a herald of the invasion that seemed soon to come, the Germans seized and occupied Guernsey, a British dependency in the Channel Islands off the coast of Normandy, less than 200 air miles from Chequers. It was a minor action. The Germans held the island with only 469 soldiers, but troubling all the same. Chapter 18. Resignation Number 1. As if war and invasion were not enough to think about, that same day, Sunday, June 30th, Churchill's close friend and counsellor and industrial miracle worker, Lord Beaverbrook, submitted his resignation. The letter began with the happy reminder that in the 7 weeks since Beaverbrook had become Minister of Aircraft Production, the output of aircraft had increased at a near inconceivable rate. The RAF now had at its disposal 1,040 aircraft ready for service, compared with 45 when he took over, though how he derived these numbers would soon become a matter of dispute. He had done what he set out to do. It was time for him to go. His conflict with the Air Ministry had become so profound as to impede his ability to perform. It is now imperative that the Ministry of Aircraft Production should pass into the keeping of a man in touch and sympathy with the Air Ministry and the Air Marshals, he wrote. He blamed himself, declaring he was not suited to working with Air Ministry officials. I am certain that another man could take up the responsibilities with hope and expectation of that measure of support and sympathy which has been denied to me. He asked to be relieved of his duties as soon as his successor had been fully briefed on his ministry's ongoing operations and projects. I am convinced, he wrote, that my work is finished and my task is over. John Colville guessed that Beaverbrook's true motive was a wish to quit at the peak of his success, before new difficulties arise. Colville considered this an unworthy reason. It is like trying to stop playing cards immediately after a run of luck, he wrote in his diary. Churchill, clearly annoyed, sent Beaverbrook his reply the following day, Monday, July 1st. Instead of addressing him as Max, or simply Beaverbrook, he began his letter with a frosty, Dear Minister of Aircraft Production, I have received your letter of June 30th, and hasten to say that at a moment like this, when an invasion is reported to be imminent, there can be no question of any ministerial resignations being accepted. I require you, therefore, to dismiss this matter from your mind, and to continue the magnificent work you are doing on which, to a large extent, our safety depends. In the meantime, Churchill told him, I am patiently studying how to meet your needs in respect of control of the overlapping parts of your department and that of the Air Ministry, and also to assuage the unfortunate differences which have arisen. A partly chastened Beaverbrook replied immediately, I will certainly not neglect my duties here in the face of invasion, but it is imperative, and all the more so because of this threat of armed attack upon our shores, that the process of turning over this ministry should take place as soon as possible. He again aired his frustrations. I cannot get information which I require about supplies or equipment. I cannot get permission to carry out operations essential to strengthening our reserves to the uttermost in readiness for the day of invasion. It is not possible for me to go on because a breach has taken place in the last 5 weeks through the pressure I have been compelled to put upon reluctant officers. This breach, he wrote, cannot be healed. But he no longer threatened immediate resignation. Churchill was relieved. Beaverbrook's departure at this time would have left an unfillable absence in the skein of counsel and succour that surrounded the Prime Minister. This would become apparent late that night when, with the threat of resignation for now stifled, Churchill felt compelled to summon Beaverbrook to 10 Downing Street to address a matter of greatest urgency. Chapter 19 Force H. The night was exceptionally dark, with almost no moon. A brisk wind shook the windows at 10 Downing. Churchill needed the counsel of a friend, a decisive, clear-eyed friend. It was just after midnight when he called Beaverbrook to the cabinet room. There was no doubt that Beaverbrook would still be awake and alert. As Minister of Aircraft Production, he kept the same hours as Churchill, prodding and cajoling his staff to find ways to get Britain's aircraft factories to accelerate production. Beaverbrook's brief insurrection had been a schoolboy's pout, aimed at eliciting Churchill's support against the Air Ministry, rather than a serious attempt at abandoning his job. Already present for the meeting were Churchill's top two Admiralty men, First Lord A.V. Alexander, and his operations chief, First Sea Lord Sir Dudley Pound. There was tension in the room. The matter of what to do about the French fleet had come down to a yes or no question. Whether or not to attempt to seize the fleet to keep it out of Hitler's hands. The Royal Navy was poised to execute a newly devised plan for the simultaneous seizure, control, or effective disablement of all the accessible French fleet, meaning any ships in such English ports as Plymouth and Southampton, as well as those moored at French bases in Dakar, Alexandria, and Mersel Kebir in Algeria. One element of the plan, codenamed Operation Catapult, focused on the most important base, Mers El Kebir, and a smaller annex 3 miles away at Oran, where some of the French Navy's most powerful ships lay at anchor, among them two modern battle cruisers, two battleships, and 21 other ships and submarines. Time was short. These ships could sail any day, and once under the control of Germany, would shift the balance of power at sea, especially in the Mediterranean. No one expected for a moment that Hitler would adhere to his promise to leave the French fleet idle for the duration of the war. An ominous development seemed to confirm the Admiralty's fears. British intelligence learned that the Germans now possessed and were using French naval codes. Once Operation Catapult got underway, Churchill knew, its commander might have to use force if the French did not willingly relinquish or disable their ships. The man placed in charge was Vice Admiral Sir J. F. Somerville, who earlier had met with his superiors in London to discuss the plan. For Somerville, the idea of firing on the French was deeply unsettling. Britain and France had been allies. Together they had declared war against Germany, and their troops had fought side by side, enduring thousands of casualties in the vain attempt to stop Hitler's onslaught. And then there was the fact that the officers and crew on the French ships were fellow Navy men. Sailors of all nations, even when at war, felt a strong kinship to one another, as brothers for whom the sea, with all its rigors and dangers, was a common opponent. They recognized a duty to rescue anyone cast adrift, whether by mishap, storm, or warfare. On Monday afternoon, Somerville had telegraphed the Admiralty, urging that the use of force should be avoided at all costs. He was prepared, however, to carry out his orders to the fullest, and he possessed the wherewithal to do so. The Admiralty had placed under his command a persuasive battle fleet, codenamed Force H, consisting of 17 ships, including a battle cruiser, HMS Hood, and an aircraft carrier, HMS Ark Royal. By Monday night, when Churchill summoned Beaverbrook, the force was already gathered at Gibraltar, ready to sail for Mers el Kebir. All Admiral Somerville needed now was a final order. At 10 Downing Street that blustery night, First Sea Lord Pound declared himself in favour of attacking the French ships. First Lord Alexander at first expressed uncertainty, but he soon sided with Pound. Churchill was still tormented. He called the matter a hateful decision, the most unnatural and painful in which I have ever been concerned. He needed Beaverbrook's clarity. And, true to form, Beaverbrook showed no hesitation. He urged attack. There could be no doubt, he argued, that Hitler would appropriate the French ships, even if their captains and crews balked. The Germans will force the French fleet to join the Italians, thus taking command of the Mediterranean, he said. The Germans will force this by threatening to burn Bordeaux the first day the French refuse, the next day Marseille, and the third day Paris. This persuaded Churchill, but just after he gave the order to proceed, the magnitude of what might soon unfold overwhelmed him. He grabbed Beaverbrook by the arm and dragged him into the garden behind 10 Downing. It was almost 2 a.m. The wind blew strong. Churchill sped through the garden with Beaverbrook behind, struggling to keep up. Beaverbrook's asthma spiked. As he stood wheezing and gulping air, Churchill affirmed that the only path was indeed attack, and began to weep. Somerville received his final orders at 4:26 a.m. on Tuesday, July 2nd. The operation was to begin with the delivery of an ultimatum from Somerville to the French admiral in command at Mers el Kebir, Marcel Gensoul, that set out three alternatives: to join England in fighting Germany and Italy, to sail to a British port, or to sail to a French port in the West Indies where the ships could be stripped of armament or transferred to the United States for safekeeping. If you refuse these fair offers, Somerville's message stated, I must with profound regret require you to sink your ships within 6 hours. Finally, failing the above, I have the orders of His Majesty's government to use whatever force may be necessary to prevent your ships from falling into German or Italian hands. Force H left Gibraltar at dawn. That night, at 10:55, Admiral Pound, at Churchill's behest, telegraphed Somerville, You are charged with one of the most disagreeable and difficult tasks that a British admiral has ever been faced with, but we have complete confidence in you and rely on you to carry it out relentlessly. In Berlin that day, Tuesday, July 2nd, Hitler asked the commanders of his army, navy and air force to evaluate the feasibility of a full-on invasion of England, the first concrete indication that he had begun seriously to contemplate such an attack. Until now, he had shown little interest in invasion. With the fall of France and the disarray of Britain's army after Dunkirk, Hitler had assumed that England, in one way or another, would withdraw from the war. It was crucial that this happen, and soon. England was the last obstacle in the West, one Hitler needed to eliminate so that he could concentrate on his long-dreamed-of invasion of Soviet Russia and avoid a two-front war, a phenomenon for which the word-minting power of the German language did not fail. Zweifrontenkrieg. He believed that even Churchill, at some point, would have to acknowledge the folly of continuing to oppose him. The war in the West was, in Hitler's view, all but over. Britain's position is hopeless, he told his head of Army High Command, General Franz Halder. The war is won by us. A reversal in the prospects of success is impossible. So confident was Hitler that England would negotiate, he demobilized 40 Wehrmacht divisions, 25% of his army. But Churchill was not behaving like a sane man. Hitler sent a series of indirect peace feelers through multiple sources, including the King of Sweden and the Vatican. All were rejected or ignored. To help avoid scuttling any opportunity for a peace deal, he forbade Luftwaffe chief Hermann Göring from launching air raids against civilian districts of London. Invasion was a prospect he contemplated with anxiety and reluctance, and with good reason. Early studies conducted independently by the German Navy, well before Hitler himself began to ponder invasion, highlighted grave obstacles, mostly centered on the fact that Germany's relatively small navy was ill-equipped for any such enterprise. The army, too, saw dangerous hurdles. Hitler's uncertainty was evident in how he now couched this new request to his commanders. He emphasized that the plan to invade England has not taken any definite shape, and that his request merely contemplated the possibility of such an invasion. He was definitive on one point, however. Any such invasion could succeed only if Germany first achieved complete air superiority over the RAF. At 3 a.m. on Wednesday, July 3rd, as Admiral Somerville's Force H neared Oran in the Mediterranean Sea, a destroyer in the group was sent out ahead with three officers to open a communications channel with the French. Nearby stood the ruins of an ancient Roman town, with the disconcerting name of Valturia. Soon afterward, a message was sent to the French admiral in charge, Jean Soule, requesting a meeting. The message began with a salvo of flattery. The British Navy hopes that their proposals will enable you and the valiant and glorious French Navy to be by our side. It assured the French admiral that if he chose to sail with the Royal Navy, your ships would remain yours and no one need have anxiety for the future. The message closed, "A British fleet is at sea off Oran, waiting to welcome you." The admiral refused to meet with the British officers, who now sent him a written copy of the full ultimatum. The time was 9:35 a.m. Britain's Admiral Somerville signalled the French. "We hope most sincerely that the proposals will be acceptable and that we shall have you by our side." Reconnaissance planes from the Ark Royal, the aircraft carrier assigned to Force H, reported signs that the French ships were preparing to sail, raising steam and furling awnings. At 10 a.m., the French admiral delivered a message affirming that he would never let the French ships fall under German control, but also vowing, in light of the ultimatum, that his ships would fight back if the British used force. He repeated this vow an hour later, pledging to spare nothing to defend his fleet. Tension mounted. At 11:40, the British sent a message stating that no French ship would be allowed to leave the harbour unless the terms of the ultimatum were accepted. British air reconnaissance reported further signs that the French fleet was getting ready to put to sea. The ship's bridges were fully manned. Admiral Somerville ordered that aircraft from the Ark Royal begin depositing mines at the mouth of the harbour. Somerville was just about to send a message telling the French that he would begin bombarding their ships at 2:30 that afternoon when word arrived from the French admiral agreeing to a face-to-face conference. By this point, Somerville suspected that the French were merely stalling for time, but he dispatched an officer all the same. The meeting, aboard the French flagship Dunkerque, began at 4:15, by which time the French ships were fully primed to sail, with tugboats in position. Somerville ordered the placement of more mines, these to be dropped in the nearby harbour at Oran. Aboard the Dunkerque, the meeting went badly. The French admiral was extremely indignant and angry, according to the British emissary. The talk continued for an hour, achieving nothing. In London, Churchill and the Admiralty grew impatient. The French admiral was clearly stalling for time, and so, it seemed, was Somerville. His reluctance to attack was understandable. Nevertheless, the time for action had come. Nightfall was approaching. There was nothing for it but to give Somerville a peremptory order to carry out the repugnant task without further question, wrote Pargismay. But all who were present when that message was drafted could not but feel sad and, in a sense, guilty. Pug had initially opposed attacking the French fleet, out of both moral scruple and fear that France might declare war on Britain. To kick a man when he is down is unattractive at any time, he wrote, but when the man is a friend who has already suffered grievously, it seems almost to border on infamy. The Admiralty wired Somerville, settle the matter quickly or you may have French reinforcements to deal with. At 4:15 p.m., while the meeting aboard the Dunkirk was just getting underway, Somerville signalled the French that if they did not accept one of the options set out in the original British ultimatum by 5:30, he would sink their ships. Force H prepared for battle. The French did likewise. As the British emissary left the Dunkirk, he heard alarms behind him sounding action. He reached his ship at 5:25 p.m., 5 minutes before Somerville's deadline. The deadline came and went. In Portsmouth and Plymouth, where the operation to seize French ships was also underway, British forces faced little resistance. The action was sudden and necessarily a surprise, Churchill wrote. Overwhelming force was employed, and the whole transaction showed how easily the Germans could have taken possession of any French warships lying in ports which they controlled. Churchill described the action in British ports as having been mostly amicable, with some French crews actually glad to leave their ships behind. One vessel resisted, the Surcouf, an immense submarine named for an 18th-century French privateer. As a British squad raced aboard, the French sought to burn manuals and scuttle the submarine. Gunfire left one French sailor dead, three British. The Surcouf surrendered. In the Mediterranean off Merselkebir, Admiral Somerville at last gave the order to open fire. The time was 5:54 p.m., nearly a half hour past his deadline. His ships were positioned at maximum visibility range of 17,500 yards, just shy of 10 miles. The first salvo fell short. The second struck a breakwater, blasting loose chunks of concrete, some of which struck the French ships. The third was on target. A large French battleship, the Bretagne, with a crew of 1,200 men, exploded, sending a great orange plume of fire and smoke hundreds of feet into the sky. A destroyer also blew up. Smoke filled the harbour, blocking the view of British spotters aboard their ships and in the air. 1 minute after the British began firing, the French began to fire back, using big shipboard guns and other heavy guns on shore. Their shells fell closer and closer to the British ships, as their gunners adjusted their aim. Somerville sent a message by wireless to London, and being heavily engaged. At 10 Downing, Churchill told First Lord Alexander that the French were now fighting with all their vigour for the first time since war broke out. Churchill fully expected France to declare war. British shells struck another French battleship, drawing forth a cascade of orange flames. A large destroyer received a direct hit as it tried to flee the harbour. In all, the ships of Force H fired 36 salvos of shells, each 15 inches in diameter and packed with high explosives, until the French guns went quiet. Somerville gave the order to cease fire at 6:04 p.m., just 10 minutes after the action began. As the smoke cleared, Somerville saw that the battleship Britannia had disappeared. The attack and the secondary actions killed 1,297 French officers and sailors. To the statistically inclined, that worked out to roughly 130 lives per minute. Nearly 1,000 of the dead had been aboard the Britannia. Somerville's Force H suffered no casualties.
At 10 Downing Street, news of the fighting began to arrive.
Churchill paced his office and kept repeating, "Terrible, terrible." The battle affected him deeply, as daughter Mary observed in her diary. "It is so terrible that we should be forced to fire on our own erstwhile allies," she wrote. "Papa is shocked and deeply grieved that such action has been necessary." Strategically, the attack yielded obvious benefits, partially crippling the French navy. But to Churchill, what mattered, just as much or more, was what it signalled. Until this point, many onlookers had assumed that Britain would seek an armistice with Hitler, now that France, Poland, Norway, and so many other countries had fallen under his sway. But the attack provided vivid, irrefutable proof that Britain would not surrender. Proof to Roosevelt, and proof, as well, to Hitler. The next day, Thursday, July 4th, Churchill revealed the story of Mers el-Kebir to the House of Commons, telling it as a kind of maritime thriller, recounting the battle as it had unfolded, in direct terms, not shying from details. He called it a melancholy action, but one whose necessity was beyond challenge. "I leave the judgment of our action with confidence to Parliament. I leave it to the nation, and I leave it to the United States. I leave it to the world and to history." The House roared its approval, rising in a wild tumult, Labour, Liberals and Conservatives alike. Churchill's great trick, one he had demonstrated before and would demonstrate again, was his ability to deliver dire news and yet leave his audience feeling encouraged and uplifted. "Fortified," is how Harold Nicholson put it in his diary that day. Despite the grim circumstances and the grimmer potential that France might now declare war on Britain, Nicholson felt something akin to elation. "If we can stick it," he wrote, "we really shall have won the war. What a fight it is, what a chance for us. Our action against the French fleet has made a tremendous effect throughout the world. I am as stiff as can be." The applause lasted for several minutes. Churchill wept. Amid the tumult, John Colville overheard him say, "This is heartbreaking for me." The public applauded as well. The Home Intelligence Survey for July 4th reported that news of the attack has been received in all regions with satisfaction and relief. It is felt that this strong action gives welcome evidence of government vigour and decision. A Gallup poll for July 1940 found that 88% of Britons approved of the Prime Minister. Within the Admiralty itself, however, there was condemnation. The senior officers involved in the attack called it an act of sheer treachery. French naval officers sent Somerville a scathing letter that, according to Pargismay, accused the admiral of having brought disgrace on the whole naval profession. Outwardly, Somerville seemed to brush off the rebuke, but, wrote Ismay, "I am sure it cut him to the quick." The episode caused a tense moment over lunch at 10 Downing Street soon afterward. Word came to Clementine that one of the expected guests, General Charles de Gaulle, now lodged in England, was in an even more obstreperous mood than usual, and that she should make sure everyone at lunch was on their best behaviour. Pamela Churchill was among those invited. At Clementine's end of the table, the conversation lurched into dangerous territory. She told de Gaulle that she hoped the French fleet would now join with Britain in the fight against Germany. To this, Pamela recalled, the general curtly replied that, in his view, what would really give the French fleet satisfaction would be to turn their guns on you, meaning against the British fleet. Clementine liked de Gaulle, but keenly aware of how deeply her husband grieved, having to sink the French ships, she now rounded on the general and, in her perfect French, took him to task for uttering words and sentiments that ill became either an ally or a guest in this country, as Pamela put it. Churchill, at the far side of the table, sought to dispel the tension. He leaned forward and, in an apologetic tone, in French, said, "You must excuse my wife, my general. She speaks French too well." Clementine glared at Churchill. "No, Winston," she snapped. She turned back to de Gaulle and again, in French, said, "That is not the reason. There are certain things that a woman can say to a man that a man cannot say, and I am saying them to you, General de Gaulle." The next day, by way of apology, de Gaulle sent her a large basket of flowers.